This is a forum entitled Euthanasia. Do we have a right to die? When and who decides? And let me just say a word about forums at Holden for those of you who have not been to one before. And then I will introduce the panelists and then sort of try to outline the questions a little bit. Forums at Holden are a time primarily for open discussion for the primary portion of the hour. What we usually try to do, however, is to have three, sometimes four people, like we do tonight, to begin the session by speaking out of their own experience, their own background on the particular issue up for discussion, as a way of starting us off for getting us into the issue and getting a little bit of substance out on the table to talk about. So what we will do is have each of our presenters to really give this sort of informal reflections, and they may do anything from give their own position on euthanasia to simply raising some of the questions that they see are particularly pertinent. Each will speak around 5 minutes or so. We're not going to gong them off the stage if they run over that. And then we will open it up, and you'll be free to ask individual presenters specific questions, or ask questions to all four of them, or to raise questions generally, or to disagree, or to add your own comments, whatever, and we'll simply open it up for discussion. And I will facilitate that as we go on. The people who are going to present are Howard Olson, who has been with us now for 2 weeks?
Three weeks.
Doing teaching sessions primarily related to aging and is involved with the senior care program in Minneapolis. John Witte, who is a doctor specializing in arthritis. I'm not sure where you're from.
Everett,
Washington. And Kent Burgess, who is from Holden as our business administrator. And previous to coming here was the administrator of a senior care center in Idaho and was very involved in the beginnings of the hospice movement in Idaho. And Kit Kleinhans, who is a pastor from Atlanta, Georgia, who's going to share with some us, particularly from the theological perspective. Okay, but before we begin, I get to talk. So, we thought it was particularly important when we met yesterday and sort of talking about this, just to begin by trying to outline very briefly what we mean by euthanasia so that we have a common understanding of that before we open it up, and just to sort of look at what the real questions are, perhaps. Euthanasia technically is a Greek word which means happy or painless death, is what it directly translated would mean. And commonly, euthanasia is defined as taking deliberate action to terminate one's life to prevent suffering. And very often we hear euthanasia being defined as mercy killing. In other words, you really are killing someone, but you're doing that out of a concern, out of their suffering. The Euthanasia Society of America defines euthanasia in that way. It says termination of human life by painless means for the purpose of ending severe physical suffering. Sometimes, however, euthanasia is defined more broadly than that, and that's the way we want to use it tonight. Webster's Dictionary defines it in the same way that the Euthanasia Society defines it, but also adds another possible definition of simply painless death. So it may not be that it has to be caused by deliberate action, if you understand the distinction there. So what I've done, just to sort of help us look at this, is to outline on the board sort of a whole spectrum of what the possibilities are really for euthanasia. And I'm going to give some examples of each of those. First, really beginning, and I've written indirect or passive in euthanasia up there in the green. But the first sort of all the way to one side of indirect or passive euthanasia would be simply enabling a relatively painless death without any active attempt to hasten death. And examples of that might be simply keeping people on oxygen when they're in respiratory distress, giving people painkillers that don't have any effect on their duration of life, are simply giving emotional and spiritual support. So really doing what we would always do. I mean, really is simply to try to help people experience less pain. Okay. The next step would be to enable death by removing barriers to death. Essentially coming to a point where it's, and probably in this case, in a case where it is clear that someone is not going to live for any substantial period of time, or that they are living really, say, either they're brain dead or they really are living what we might consider a subhuman life. And there's no direct, deliberate action taken to kill them, but simply what is done is removing life support systems. For instance, one, or not giving them particular medical treatment that would be needed to continue to keep them alive. One example, I've gotten these, by the way, out of a book by our now Surgeon General, who sort of outlines the issue in this way, which I think was helpful. One example was withholding blood transfusions when somebody has had a hemorrhage in the stomach, when it's already very clear that that person's going to die of stomach cancer. And so essentially that person would still die from natural causes, from a hemorrhage. But you are making the decision not to give them a blood transfusion, which may prolong their life for a short period of time. A third would be enabling death by a medical act designed to relieve suffering, with a possible side effect being that their life may be shortened. The example there that was given was giving somebody morphine, knowing that the more you give the morphine, they're going to require larger doses of morphine and more frequent doses of morphine in order to relieve the pain. And eventually that may mean that the amount of morphine needed to relieve the pain will probably lead to their death. And finally, the fourth is really the definition of euthanasia that we began with, which is deliberately enabling death by a medical act deliberately intended to terminate their life, like giving somebody a drug overdose. Knowing that someone's in so much pain that you simply can't, they can't take it any longer, you can't take it any longer, and you think the most merciful thing to do is to kill them. So that's really sort of the spectrum. I want to just say that very often when we talk about euthanasia, we automatically talk about that exclusively around people who have lived and are apparently dying. We may at some point want to also talk about euthanasia for newborn babies. For instance, there's a whole issue of, say, newborn babies who are in who are very painfully deformed. Sometimes people make the decision to essentially let them starve. There's those kinds of questions too that we may at some point want to get into. And I think just to finish out, let me just read one paragraph of questions. Essentially, I think, are raised by all this. Well, where is it? There it is. Does a patient have the right to expect a painless, comfortable death? Does he have the right to expect that his physician should see that it is so? Does she have the right to expect that the physician might take an active role in her dying process to shorten it for the sake of the patient's comfort or peace of mind? Does the patient have the right to expect the physician to terminate his life if the physician deems it advisable? Could this ever be an active role on the part of the physician, or may She assumes only a passive role. Is there a difference between an active and a passive role in this regard? Is a deed of omission less reprehensible than a deed of commission, legally, ethically, or morally? Does the patient have the right to participate in the decision, or better yet, to influence it? Those are really some of the ethical, I think, legal questions that come out of that. And then from there, you run into all sorts of questions about how do you know whether the person's going to die or not? Who assesses that? Financial kinds of questions, pressure from the family, who decides, and all those kinds of things. So, with that, I will shut up and be the facilitator from now on, and start with Howard. We decided we would just move in this order and on down. So I'll just let each of you move from one to the other.
Thank you. I first became acquainted with this general subject 3 years ago. I was working in a nursing home in more of a foundation capacity, but they invited me to be on the ethics committee, and this committee of 12 people, including three pastors from the seminary, several physicians, and people that work in the nursing home. And when you get into biomedical ethics, it isn't long before you get on the subject of living wills, and euthanasia comes right into it immediately. One purpose of the ethics committee was to attempt to develop a good policy for the nursing home as to when people should live and when they should die. And I can't say that they made much progress in the year that I met with them, but they're working on a very complex problem. This book I picked up is The Family, the Courts, and the Constitution, and it says, who decides whether a member of a family will live or die? And it tells of a case here just a few years ago when Governor Lamb of State of Colorado made some very outlandish remarks about terminating the death of people that were in nursing homes. I'll just read a little bit of this. It says, our society has traditionally held that suicide and euthanasia are both morally and legally wrong. However, advances in modern medicine have resulted in a number of situations where people who in the past would have died can now be kept alive for relatively long periods of time. And sometimes a person's condition is so poor, the pain so unbearable, well, the chance of recovery is so remote that a question arises as to whether it would be merciful to keep the person alive. And these are the types of questions that have to be dealt with. When Governor Lamb made his whatever considered outlandish remarks, there were a number of editorials published around the country. One of them in a Boston paper said, is it a duty to die? And it points out both sides of the question we're talking about tonight. When can you take a life, and when can people decide about their own life? And just prior to that, there was a paraplegic who wanted to die, and he wasn't allowed to take his own life, and he had written a book, Whose Life Is It Anyway? So this whole question continues to arise, and it gets back to the matter of ethics, and I think that's why we have a pastor here on our panel. And I want to read a couple paragraphs from this book here on Second Opinion, Ethical Issues in Medicine, Catholic, Lutheran, Reformed Perspectives. How religious faith should or actually does influence specific moral decisions is not easy to resolve. It certainly is true that Christian persons facing moral decisions are likely to have general convictions about the importance of human life, respect for others, responsibility toward humanity and the rest of creation, and accountability to God. They may be aware of human pride, selfishness, sloth, and shortness of knowledge and vision. Ideally, Christians also are formed and sustained in communities in which the virtues appropriate to these insights are nurtured, so they are born into all areas of life. Those are some of the deep considerations. There's been a great deal done about this, and one of our senators, whose name you might recall, Jacob Javits, senator from New York for many years, commented just a few years ago, because he was on the Health Committee of the Senate, there is finally the question of money, which plays a part in even this sort of decision. Many people were shocked last year when Governor Richard Lamb of Colorado urged people who had no real prospect of life to, quote, get out of the way and stop using resources that could be used more profitably by other people. This sounded callous, and it probably was, but it was the truth. We have not yet reached the point, even in this glorious nation, where we continue to sustain these economics. That is what makes the right to die with dignity an issue of morality as well as policy and law. Whether we are old or young, healthy or ill, we cannot go on shirking the questions of who shall live, who shall die, and who shall decide. So it's very complex. I'll turn over to the doctor.
I'm a rheumatologist. I deal with patients with arthritis. They generally aren't that terribly ill, but many of them are elderly, and most of them are suffering. And occasionally they do become very ill, and of course die. And I come up with these decisions like we've been talking about quite frequently. I don't have any special training in biomedical ethics. I also have to admit that I've probably done more thinking on the topic of euthanasia in the last 2 days than I have in the last 10 years of dealing with patients. I'm not an advocate for or against, and I guess my ideas are kind of evolving, like I hope everybody else's are. Barry said much of what I was going to say, so I'll improvise a little bit here. I'm glad he brought up the idea of a continuum and that this isn't a clear-cut black and white issue, that a lot of this continuum has been brought out because of the development in medical technology in recent years. We can keep patients alive far beyond what would normally be considered a person's natural life. And this brings up all sorts of issues. Are we, by withholding different forms of care, actually participating or in that person's death? Is that right or wrong? I think if somebody is 95 years old and their heart is failing, I don't think anybody would say we should transplant a heart in that person. But on the other side of the continuum or the spectrum, if you have somebody that's been suffering and they have a stroke and they can no longer eat, should we but all their other bodily functions are working, should we put a tube down and feed them and sustain their life? Or should we withhold food and in a sense starve them? And that's not a very pleasant death. And still they're suffering from inability to move, and they're no longer leading the quality of life that they've been accustomed to. So it can certainly be argued that it's much more merciful to simply come in and give them a lethal injection on the other hand. So if we withhold food, we're doing something passively, we're kind of turning our backs, and on the other hand we're doing something actively, and there's a whole continuum between active and passive. So I would like to define euthanasia as the decision that a certain person's life is going to end. And whether we do that actively or passively, I'm not sure it matters. That's more of a legal question, I think, that once that decision is made, that is euthanasia. When we start doing things actively, then the question is raised, are we playing God? And I think we're already doing that. It's a very uneasy subject for me when I know a person, or the odds are 99% that they're not going to pull through. We can hook them up to respirators and plug in tubes and have them suffer, knowing full well that the overwhelming odds are they're not going to make that, and their last couple of weeks are going to be agony. I would consult with the family, the patient, if they're in a state of mind where they can participate in that decision, and arrive at, you know, what do they want to do. And so if I decide that this is not in their best interest, we're not going to plug in the tubes, put them on a respirator, that's a little bit playing God already. And is it any different if a person is suffering from terminal cancer and saying, well, let's end their life now rather than a month from now with more suffering. In that sense, the family, the patient, and I'm playing God, but on the other sense, if we turn our backs, then maybe it's the cancer cells that are playing God. I think that we're as much instruments in this world, God's instruments in this world, as a cancer cell or a virus or a bacteria that will eventually terminate that person's life. People die because of illness. And we get all things all twisted up when we talk about God's will. I think that a physician and a caring family and a person has a little bit more intelligence and in terms of deciding what is in that person's best interest than these natural forces. So. About what I have to say.
Yeah. If I was going to be real short, I'd say that I thought this was a really complex and difficult issue, and just leave it at that.
But you're not going to.
But I'm not going to be short. In the midst of, I think this has become a nationwide discussion. In the midst of that discussion, a lot of decisions are being made, and a lot of people are living, and a lot of people are dying. In the last 13 years, I was a nursing home administrator, and was more involved in those decision-making processes than I wished to be. In the last 6 years, very actively had a hospice program, and was involved in 84 deaths to some degree last year. And I'd have to say, in being all in that is probably a lot of the reason that I would hold in the last 8 months that I've been here, I've not at all missed that. Unfortunately, I'd have to say I thought I was pretty good at that, of working with physicians and families and patients. But it was difficult and often didn't like the legal position that you felt in and the position that you risked and the anger that you would feel. So I'd have to say in many ways, for the last 8 months at Holden, I've erased my memory tapes on a lot of that. So the easiest way for me to say that it's an easy and difficult issue, I think, is to tell a factual story. That occurred would have been almost a year ago. One day I got a call from our director of social services, and we had a policy in our nursing home and our hospice and our home health agency not to take patients that were being dumped on us. Especially with elderly people involved in hospitals, there's a new reimbursement system called DRGs, diagnosis-related groups, and we were seeing a very rapid discharge of elderly people from a hospital. And some of that, frankly, very appropriately. And I wouldn't argue with that. But it was a real problem to be called at 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon saying that they were going to send us four patients later that afternoon. So we had a set policy that said, there's a pre-admission process and you need to go through that. Director of Social Service calls me and says, I think you need to take this phone call. And so I took the phone call, and there was a man on the other end of the line. He was obviously very distressed, and he said, my wife is in another state with her son, and the hospital said, you have to get out today, and I was to find a nursing home for him to go to. And I said, well, boy, we don't do that here. but I was so curious, and at that point the man was crying, and I had found out that I said, well, you said your wife's son is not your son. No, it's my stepson. I said, well, can you tell me a little more about that? And he said, well, he's 14 years old and he was involved in a motorcycle accident. He was immediately taken to the emergency room, and seen by the ER physician and a consulting neurologist, who suggested that he be flown immediately to a bigger and larger hospital that happened to be in the next state. That happened. The mother then went to that state, stayed by the bedside of her 14-year-old son. The hospital then determined that there was basically nothing that could be done for this boy. And I believe at that point there was some real financial things that I was to find out about later. And determined that he was to be discharged that day, and that was their problem, and they were willing to fly him back to our town to do that. Well, as I listened to this man's story, I said, well, this is ludicrous. I said, they can't do that. They cannot just tell you they're going to discharge today in this case. You have a right to appropriate discharge planning. You have not received that right. And I could tell the man was in no position to argue his case, so I said, I'll argue it for you. And so I called this hospital in this other state, and normally would ask to speak to social service, ask to speak to somebody in administration, was asked what I needed to talk to somebody about. I said that didn't matter. I finally ended up with an assistant administrator, and I said, I relayed the story to them, and I said, you are doing a total injustice to this family. You have not provided adequate discharge planning. And I tried to use every sort of threatening, legalistic word that I could use and said, if this man and his family do not sue you, I will. And they said, well, I'm really not familiar with this case, and let us get back to you. And somebody got back to me and said, well, you know, what's the problem here? And I said, you know, you cannot do this. And they said, well, what do you want then if you want transferred to your nursing home? And I said, well, I want to talk to the physicians here in town that dealt with that individual. We'll get back to you, etc. The end result was this 14-year-old child was flown back to our town, admitted to our nursing home.
After the weekend,
yeah. It was probably a process of 5-6 days before that happened. We acquired as much information as we could. Then the boy came, we put him in the room, the mother came, and we found out what a really complex issue we were dealing with. The head injuries were so severe that his brain would not control his body temperature and would not make his kidneys work. But they were having a very, very difficult time determining the amount of brain activity. At one point he had been labeled brain dead, then they said no, and they were all over. But then we found out that the medication that this boy was on, I think it was called Petresin, that made his kidneys function or work, was costing us $60 a day. And then because his brain wouldn't control his body temperature, we had to get a cooling blanket, which is something I had never heard of, and I'd been doing this a long time, that would, if his body got too cold, would warm it back up. If it got too hot, cool it back down. And that was like, we had to rent that at like $80 a day. So at this point, just in those two items, it's $140 a day. Well, because of the financial situation of the family, our reimbursement was Medicaid, a welfare program, of which we were reimbursed $36.38 a day to provide the care for this child. So we're going to do it $160 a day, no, nothing else. At that point, we had no attending physician, because no physician in our town really wanted to take on this case. But we had somebody who specialized in infectious diseases. And we had a good relationship with her, and she offered to take the case, and she was going to have other people support her. Well, she decided, as she worked with the family, as the nurses and I, it really became the issue of that we probably should withdraw the Petresin, which would probably eventually cause the boy to seizure and die. Because it appeared that it was fairly obvious that he had no quality of life. And the mother obviously struggled with this decision very much. But then that's when it started to get complex. Because once we had about reached this decision, the infectious disease physician consulted with the neurologist, who said, if you withdraw the Petressin, I will sue you because you will be murdering that child. Well, that got back to me, and I thought, you know, here we are, we're into this about $300 a day, and I started to realize why they probably were going to discharge that boy that day. And I have to be honest with you, nursing homes do not make massive amounts of money. So in the midst of that, that became very difficult. To make a long story short.
You go ahead and take a couple more minutes.
Okay. We then turned it over to the Hospital Ethics Committee, who determined that it probably was right to withdraw the Petressin, which was a voice of support for us against the neurologist, but further encouraged that we get a court order to so do that, and that the mother initiate that. So we went through the court process, and the judge said, is the physician in agreement? Yes. Is the facility in agreement? Yes. Is the mother in agreement? Yes. Is the father in agreement? Well, we haven't asked the father. Well, the father, who she was divorced from, was in prison in California. We then had to get a statement from him saying it was okay to withdraw this Petressin. We went through that process. Once we got that all into place, we made the decision to withdraw it. But then our own nursing staff split in half. And half of them thought that we had made the right decision, and the other half didn't believe that we had faith in God enough and that we were giving up too early. So then we had massive amounts of staff meetings to deal with that issue. The Petressin was withdrawn. The boy seizured after about 10 days and died with his mother with him, and it was a fairly good death. For me, it's a very complex and difficult issue. I was involved in a national demonstration project on bioethics called No Easy Choices. At a forum much like this, I said, that is the worst title I have ever heard. It should be, there are no good choices. The problem is given that we as a society, we as an institution, we as a medical community are frozen in place. We're afraid to act. At that time when I said, no, there are no good choices, a concept that Martin Luther said, when said, given no choice but to sin, choose to sin boldly. Well, given no choices but good choices, I think we have to decide and do that boldly and with great faith. That's difficult, it's risky, and it's scary. But it's happening, and it's very, very difficult and complex.
You said what I was going to say.
No, I noticed you're armed with the Bible and the Lutheran Book of Worship, so.
It's not an LBW. This is a surprise. The theological aspects of an issue like this aren't uncomplicated either. My remarks fall into three parts, sort of raising the issue, a little talk about decision making, and finally a bottom line where I think the gospel speaks to all of us about this issue. This is not a new issue. Euthanasia is something that people have been talking about a lot for the last 10 or 15 years, but I want to share with you the first recorded euthanasia story in the Bible. A euthanasia story because it deals with this issue. We don't actually know what happened. But at the end of the book of 1 Samuel in the Old Testament, there's an account given of the death of Saul. 1 Samuel 31. The Philistines made war on Israel, and the men of Israel fled from the Philistines and were slaughtered on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pressed Saul and his sons hard and killed Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. The fighting grew heavy about Saul. The bowmen took him off his guard so that he fell wounded by the bowmen. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and run me through with it. I do not want these uncircumcised men to come and gloat over me." But his armor-bearer was afraid and would not do it. So Saul took his own sword and fell on it. That raises a couple of issues, I think. First, we need to note that Saul was not afraid of death. Kent used the phrase a minute ago, quality of life. What Saul was afraid of is the kind of life he would have if the Philistines captured him, and he did not want that kind of life. Choosing his own death was for Saul a preferable option. So he asked someone to help him end his life, and that someone was afraid and would not do it, this passage tells us. So already, when is this, 1,000 years before the birth of Christ, we've got people struggling with this issue. If a person wants to die, can I or should I help that person? The interesting thing is that in the book of 2 Samuel, there's another account of Saul's death in which a soldier comes to David and tells David, Saul asked me to kill him, and I did. So you've got these two different stories. Most commentators don't look at it. You know, they just try to say which one's which. Which is earliest, which is more authentic. And in looking at this today, I thought that perhaps one of the questions this raised for us was, which is better, euthanasia or suicide? You know, which did the people want to deal with? The fact that a leader of theirs would kill him or take his own life? The fact that a leader of theirs would choose to have someone else help do it? So these are issues that people have been struggling with a long time. This is not a Lutheran book of worship. This is an occasional services book. It's a companion to the Lutheran book of worship. Some of you may have seen it. It's a book that most Lutheran pastors have, and it's called occasional services because it provides services that you don't do all the time. One of the services in this book is a service for healing. I don't know if anybody's church is here. Anyone here has a church where the service is used. My congregation, we use this often during Lent. I think Lutherans and many other mainline Christians are afraid to talk about healing because we think it's demanding miracles from God. This is an excellent service, and if your congregation hasn't used it, I encourage you to talk to your pastor and raise the issue, because it's a service that talks about healing physically, emotionally, spiritually. We say that we believe God can heal. And I think one of the ways in which God heals us is in the midst of difficult times, in the midst of decision making. I imagine that in the situation that Kent just related to us, there was an awful lot of prayer going on and an awful lot of concern about God and God's will for us, God's people. And I think a service like this can help us center that. And I just want to share with you one prayer from this service. There are a number of petitions praying for people who are sick, people who are near death, those who are agents of healing, doctors, nurses, other medical personnel. There are prayers for the family and friends of the sick person. And finally, there's a prayer for those making decisions. O Lord our God, send your Holy Spirit to guide us, that we may make our decisions with love, mercy, and reverence for your gift of life. Through your Son, Jesus Christ our Lord. I think the message of that prayer in the context of this service is to say, there is no right or wrong answer. The Christian faith is not going to tell you what to do. But it does give us the strength to make the decisions that we are called to make, using all the resources and all the God-given faculties we have. After Luther says sin boldly, in the quote that Kent shared with us, he goes on to say, rejoice more boldly still in Christ. And he ends that passage by saying, pray boldly.
Kent didn't read the pardon.
Well, it's in a letter to Philip Melanchthon from the Wartburg in 1521. And the bottom line, you've had your Old Testament, you've had your Luther, now you get your New Testament. I think the bottom line, again, there are no easy answers.
Are you putting Luther on the same level as Old and New Testament
here? I put him in the middle to keep him company. Yeah. It would be a fun take. There are no easy answers. Life is not easy. But I think when we face life's difficult issues, our faith is what enables us to get through those issues better and with more grace than people who don't have faith to draw on. As far as I'm concerned, the bottom line is found in Paul's letter to the Romans, the 14th chapter. The life and death of each of us has its influence on others. If we live, we live for the Lord. And if we die, we die for the Lord, so that alive or dead, we belong to the Lord. I think that's enough to get us going.
Thanks, Lord. Okay, thanks to all four of you for sharing with that of your thoughts and experience. And we simply now, as I said before, open it up for questions that you can address to any of them specifically, or to all of them generally, or making your own comments or relating your own experience. So I'll simply open it up for any comments that people have. And I would like to ask, because we have a number of people here, if you would raise your hand so that we can, some people are better at speaking out than others, so to try to make sure that everyone gets a chance that wants to speak, if you could raise your hand and I'll recognize people. And those of you who are up in the balcony, please wave your hand a little bit so I can see it. Yes.
For the doctor and MD here, I was wondering about the question of the Hippocratic Oath that the doctors take and how that, if that needs some adaptation or anything, and I don't remember exactly how it goes.
I don't either.
He's always supporting, life regardless. It's kind of the general impression that I had of it.
The Hippocratic Oath has been changed in a lot of medical schools. Basically, that is a formality of graduation, and they have changed that, the wording of that. Not every school does the same thing. I can't remember what my school did. Basically, once you're out in practice, though, you're acting in the best interest of your patient. And I question whether that is always prolonging life. I know, yeah, I do more than question, sometimes it isn't. Then we get into the whole issue of how active or passive we want to be in letting that life end.
Yeah, so it's acting in the best interest of the patient rather than just the simple prolonging life.
Right, right. And basically relieving suffering. I mean, I don't think any buddy would, you hear these accounts I think there was one in the news not too long ago that somebody was sentenced to several life terms for mercy killing. I mean, this was one individual that an orderly or somebody took it upon themselves. I mean, that is obviously not to be condoned, and that person got what he deserved. But away from that, things get very gray in a big hurry.
There is the problem of the motive of the one who might make this decision. Now, the orderly that you spoke of, perhaps he was getting tired of cleaning up after some of these patients that couldn't control their bodily functions. Might have been his motive for doing that. Well, that wouldn't be a Christian or a good motive. And then there's the problem raised about finances, and perhaps somebody decides on euthanasia because the relative of whatever relative is using up all the money to die when they expected to inherit some. So that only piles on more complex and dilemmas in the problem. But the way I've always thought about it, when God in the creation gave man dominion over the animals of the world, but he kept dominion over us for himself. And that, I don't disagree with allowing somebody, not giving antibiotics right away when a person is in their 90s and they get pneumonia, because that's what used to carry them off would terminate their life, really, if they had no cancer, only even for cancer patients. If they're, well, you said stomach feeding. I have an aunt that made her daughter promise she would not allow them. She'd had it much earlier in her life, and it was very traumatic to her. And so my cousin would not allow them to put the tube in to feed her in the stomach.
Those are all things along that continuum.
But you know, what we do doesn't solve it. Remember the girl in the coma. Her parents wanted the life support taken off, and then she lived for quite a while after it. And that was what they wanted her life to be terminated when God decided it. That they didn't want it just mechanically. In order, you don't know whether it was going past.
I question whether God is working any more personally by through cancer cells, through bacteria, viruses, than physicians, family, and the person's own intellect.
Well, you have to work that out for yourself.
Yeah.
And we lost our youngest daughter at the age of 22 and a half. And it did quite a bit of soul-searching and thinking. And I realized that we do not all have the same lifespan. God gives us the life. And I feel that he gives us the amount of life that he intends us to have. Because we don't all live to 98 and die at 98. We die at different times. But I still feel that our lives are in his hands. And that I don't feel that he decides that my lifespan's going to be up and I'm going to drop dead right there. That it's one of those things that we'll not know the complete answer.
Well, if he's acting by us prolonging life, can't he also act by shortening life?
Yeah, I'll tell you what, instead of carrying on a two-person conversation here, let's get a few other people get in. There's somebody in the back in the red shirt that had her hand up for a while.
I would like to have the panel discuss that issue of living wills. I think that's something that we as individuals who are in our right mind at this time should be interested in having discussed.
Maybe you know something about that.
I'll jump in a little bit of a related thing. I have not had personal experience with living wills, but I think what I can share out of my own experience is the same for living wills. They're a good idea, but they don't always work. Last summer, my step-grandfather died after a series of heart attacks and a very prolonged hospitalization. And the family reached a point when my step-grandfather's condition had stabilized, of saying, when the next heart attack comes, we do not want any artificial means used to prolong his life. Let him have his heart attack and die. The family knew that, the doctors knew that, the nurses knew that, Everybody knew that except the weekend afternoon shift, and that was when he had his last heart attack. And before anybody knew it, he was hooked up to a whole bunch of machines, simply because those people there didn't know what everybody else knew we wanted. And that complicated the situation. He was on artificial life support for another week and finally stabilized enough so that we could take the life support away. And then he lived for about 24 hours and died. But that's one problem with living wills, and I think the same thing is true of organ donation and all sorts of things like that. You think because you've got it on a piece of paper that somebody is going to pay attention and that it's all solved. But practically, you know, in the hustle and bustle of hospital life, it doesn't always make a difference what you've got down on paper.
Nice. But it helps. I think everyone here in this room should think carefully for yourself while we're in our right mind what we personally need to do about living wills. I have one. It filed with my doctor, with my hospital. But if you go to a nursing home in the state of Washington, you must have your living will pinned on you if you leave the nursing home to go to a hospital. Because if that document doesn't come with you, with your living body, they can hook all the stuff up they want to you, as I understand it. And when my husband was in the hospital, the life care center, for 18 months, we were very careful to keep that very close so that that could go with him in case he did return to the hospital. So I think living wills are important for everybody to check out, and it's entirely your own feeling. If you don't feel that God wants you to do it, then you're not going to do it. It's an individual matter, and I think this panel has been splendid tonight. I like what they said, but it simmers down to, I think, an individual matter of how you feel. I don't want any more tubes, and when I'm ready to go, I'm ready to go. I've had a good life. So why should I be asking a doctor to hook me up to a bunch of stuff and keep me for another month? That's just my philosophy. But I think we're coming into an age where we're going to have to meet it head on, and I'm not sure that laws are going to be the answer. And you had your individual, every individual has their own personal deep feelings about death and family and spouse.
Let me get a comment over here and then see if anybody else on the panel has anything.
Well, I think of an older doctor who left his practice with a young man, and he had a terminal cancer patient, and the young doctor gave the patient a blood transfusion, and the old doctor was flipping mad. He said, that's not medicine, it's torture. And I agree. The only one here I would totally disagree with is the last one. I don't think we have a right to actually bring on the death. And in this case with a 14-year-old child, and the only thing to do was to remove the medicine. You're not going to save anybody, you're not. Continuous. And certainly I don't want to stretch me. The doctors asked my father that, do you want to try to keep him alive the next 24 hours? And I said, no way, keep him comfortable. Because it was obvious he was gone. He had a massive stroke, he'd had one 8 years before. There was no way he was going to live, and everybody knew it.
Did any of you have anything you want to say about Liam?
Well, Living Will last year. We had these sessions. I had two fellows with me, from one from Chicago, one from Racine, Wisconsin, with very large nursing homes. And the subject of Living Wills came up, and they said many people change their minds, or the family changed their mind, what they call current choice, isn't there some term like that? So many times the Living Will doesn't work
the way
it's destined to work. And the family disagrees at the last moment, and they have conflicts at the bedside, and some relative flies in from New York, says, keep mother alive, and everybody else agreed that they don't want to, and so forth. So there's a lot of discrepancy in the subject.
They're not always legal either. And the legislature here in Washington is almost refusing to touch that. I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's a hot potato.
Requires three physicians in conference all agreeing that every family member from, you know, wherever has to agree, and that if you can't reach second aunt so-and-so, that the whole thing's off. And it just isn't a practice. It's being done, don't get me wrong, but the medical profession and hospitals frequently go out on a legal limb by carrying out the legal or the living wills. And it's very uncomfortable, not only emotionally and spiritually, but legally in doing this. I think it's a wonderful idea, and I guess you just have to have the courage to go and first of all make it, and then for the physician and the medical community to carry it out and do it boldly.
My first response to the issue was practical. I've come up with a spiritual response since then, which is to say that regardless of the practicalities or impracticalities of something like a living will, one great thing about it is that it's such a wonderful opportunity to talk with the people who love you and who are part of your family. And if this is something that you do work through with your loved ones while you still can, it will save them a hell of a lot of pain. And I do mean a hell of a lot of pain once you're no longer able to participate in the decision-making process. It's a wonderful way of taking away some of the burden that's going to be there anyway.
Other comment? Yes, Carol.
I think that it's the crux of the matter of the dilemma for society is taking responsibility, because the ideal, of course, is, as she was saying, if each of us could individually somehow make our wishes permanently known, or known in such a way that they'd be carried out at the time of our death. But everyone's mentioned all the unfortunate complications that can bring, much less for our children. We usually wouldn't be thinking on those lines, but clearly here's the case of a 14-year-old, and death can come at any moment. And so where it gets really confusing is when we're asking society to, or ourselves as a society, to take responsibility for not making a choice, maybe, but setting up a mechanism to make a choice, because we're all stuck like Saul's shield bearer, who said, no, I don't want to take responsibility for your death.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Yes,
I think Kent hit what I think is the nail on the head, and that's it, that every doctor I know practically gives medicine and advice and so forth to keep from being sued.
I would not say, that's not what I said.
you mentioned
in that case, I would have to say
defensive medicine is what I
think one of the most positive, a couple of positive things. The first comment, I don't think living wills are effective, but what she said about the conversation, our whole fear of talking about death in the society. The one thing we're sure about is death and taxes, but we never talk about death. I don't know if we all have some sense of immortality. That we need to come to grips with that. And the fact that more than likely the decisions fall outside the realm of individual and family most times. What I see positively happening in this country is what I think is the hospice movement. which is basically nothing fancy and nothing different, but it's a whole process of saying that death is natural. Our medical philosophy is to diagnose the problem, treat the problem, and cure the problem. Well, when we've done those three and there is no cure, we don't know what to do. We're starting, I think, to come to grips with the fact that that cure isn't always possible, but care is still needed. The issue that in healthcare, government is the largest purchaser of healthcare, not us. And government now has sanctioned hospice through the Medicare program. I think it's a positive way of starting to deal with looking at death as a natural process, quality versus quantity of life issues.
We have just a couple more minutes. Are there other questions? Yes.
I just want to make a comment about as far as God will when we die. I was at a funeral, or my friend was at a funeral, where it was a 42-year-old woman died from a heart attack complicated by diabetes. And the pastor there said her death was not God's will. Her body just could not sustain the ravaging of her disease, just could not sustain, and her body just could not handle life anymore. And what I wanted to point out was that whether or not it's original sin or a very specific driving a motorcycle, having a motorcycle accident, each one of our deaths is man's will, not God's will. I just wanted to bring that out. I was wondering if God's will is just kind of an excuse to avoid the grieving process or deny death.
Sure, we can have another forum on that.
Deserve it too.